The views and opinions of this program are those of its hosts and guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of 90.1 FM KKFI, Midcoast Radio Project, or its staff and volunteers.
This is The 10th Voice, Kansas City's gay and lesbian radio magazine. The 10th Voice, because you refuse to be silent.
Hello, KKFI listeners, and welcome to Trans Talk, this week's edition of The 10th Voice. I'm Fiona Nowling, here with my co-hostess Una Nowling. Behind the board today is our sound engineer and producer, Linda Wilson. We have two special guests in our studio this week to talk with us, continuing our series on local transgender lives. First, we will speak with Grace Cox Johnson, who many of you know is the leader of the Kansas City Transgender Chorus, now called Transfinity KC. Next, we will speak with Gus, a local transgender man who has been an educator and voice in the community and who is here to share his story with us. I will finish up the show with the community calendar update. But first, let's take a look at some of the LGBT news of the week with my wife, Una.
Well, folks, the Republican National Convention has departed like an unwelcome Thanksgiving guest. You know, like when you're forced to invite your brother-in-law and he spends the whole time at dinner talking about the New World Order and the orbital mind control lasers. But just like the Republican convention, even when he finally departs in his pickup truck, which proudly proclaims, quote, "the South shall rise again," unquote, the miasma of the unpleasantness remains. Foremost in this miasma was the release of the official Republican Party platform, which promises to end all accommodation for transgender students in schools and universities, calling equality and civil rights for transgender students, quote, "an ideology alien to America's history and traditions," unquote. It further promises to do anything possible, including mandating an acid test for Supreme Court justices and federal judges, to reverse the right to same-sex marriage and to nullify all existing such marriages. In other words, the party which pounds its Bibles on behalf of family values is launching an assault on more than 500,000 families. But wait, there's more. No, there is, really. Before failed presidential candidate Ben Carson spoke at the Republican National Convention Tuesday night, he spent much of his day railing against transgender people. Claiming that being transgender is the height of absurdity, Carson equated transgender persons to delusional persons who try to become a different race. And I quote exactly, "Wouldn't that be the same as if you woke up tomorrow morning after seeing a movie about Afghanistan or reading some books and said, you know what, I'm Afghanistan," unquote. In other words, calling himself the country. He's built a wall around the dictionary, but unfortunately he's standing on the wrong side of it. In an interview with Katie Couric, Carson went on to insist that transgender persons not only do not deserve any extra rights, as he called it, but the transgender community needed to learn how to show tolerance and respect towards Republicans. He's got a pair of brass ones, doesn't he? Last week, transgender woman Crystal Cash was shot in the face as she worked at the cosmetics business she runs in Evansville, Indiana. Cash survived the brutal attack, but she is seriously injured and currently unable to speak. Her attacker, Gerald Dwayne Lewis, is a member of a prominent anti-LGBT church, which has been identified as a hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center. Despite that background information, and despite the fact that Lewis yelled an anti-gay slur at Cash before shooting her, the Evansville Police Department, in its wisdom, has refused to classify the crime as a hate crime. Even more sickening, the police not only misgendered Cash as a man, but they also implied that she was a prostitute. Should it be any surprise at all, therefore, that this crime and the police victimization of Cash occurred in the same state which gave us Donald Trump's vice presidential running mate, Mike Pence, a known opponent and hater of the LGBT community? Gosh, let me check my magic eight ball. In positive transgender news, the United States Episcopal Church has come out strongly in opposition to all laws which attempt to restrict or criminalize access to toilets that match a transgender person's gender identity. Presiding Bishop Michael Curry wrote that discriminatory laws, such as those passed in North Carolina, have, and I quote, decimated the civil rights and God-given dignity of transgender people. Bishop Curry further cites the Gospel of Matthew by writing, Jesus tells us to love God and love our neighbor as ourselves, and he tells us over and over again not to be afraid. Instead, laws such as this one, known as House Bill 2, are an example where fear has got the better of people. Bishop Curry wrote that this same fear and hatred was responsible for sickening and shocking events like the massacre targeting lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando. In other positive news, the National Basketball Association has announced that they are moving the All-Star Game from Charlotte, North Carolina, to another location outside of the state. The driver for this was the passage of North Carolina House Bill 2, previously mentioned, a law which eliminated widespread anti-discrimination protections for LGBT persons and which specifically targeted transgender individuals by criminalizing their use of gender-congruent bathroom and locker facilities. In response to the NBA's decision, North Carolina Governor and longtime transphobe Pat McCrory stated, quote, American families should be on notice that the selective corporate elite are imposing their political will on communities in which they do business, thus bypassing the democratic and legal process, unquote. This bizarre and factually incorrect statement made no mention of the fact that the law was passed by Republicans following the will of the religious elite, imposing their political will upon these same communities. A quick kudos to Christine Garcia, who late last week became San Diego, California's first transgender police officer ever. The 9-year veteran of the force recently completed her gender transition on the job, where, by her own words, she received nothing but positivity from her department and her fellow officers, as well as community leaders and those she works with in the San Diego area. In international transgender news, this week India approved the Transgender Persons Protection of Rights Bill, which puts into place provisions for stringent punishment, including imprisonment up to 2 years, for offenses against transgender and third gender individuals. The law prohibits forcing transgender persons to move from their home or leave a residence, bans forcibly removing their clothes and parading them around naked. Yes, this is actually a problem in India. Or forcing them to beg or enter into voluntary slavery. And in Pakistan, Muslim transgender persons were finally given the right to marry by a fatwa issued in late June, although only to persons of the other sex and only if they are a gender binary transgender person. Non-binary transgender persons are not allowed to marry, nor are gay or lesbian transgender persons either. As small a concession as this may seem, we must remember it is Pakistan, a country where transgender persons were not even allowed to vote or inherit property until 2012. Joanna Lumley, one of the stars of the hit TV series and current film Absolutely Fabulous, has claimed that the character of Patsy in the franchise is in fact a transgender woman. While some have accused the show of trying to ride the recent publicity wave of transgender awareness, according to the Daily Mail, hints of Patsy's transgender past have been dropped several times prior, such as in 2003 when Lumley stated that Patsy was once male and sported a mustache. While the producers have treated this as no big deal, some transgender persons have wondered why they aren't supposed to be offended that a character known for her drunkenness, drug use, nymphomania, sadomasochism, kleptomania, shallowness, vapidity, promiscuity, and general all-around incompetence is now suddenly transgender. For what it's worth, the film also features known transphobe Barry Humphries in his role as Dame Edna, so it's pretty clear transgender sensitivity did not answer the casting call. Finally, we can always count on Caitlyn Jenner for a little bit of comedy relief, and she doesn't fail us this month by announcing in a televised publicity event that it is more difficult to come out as a Republican in America than it is to come out as transgender. This, of course, explains to us all why each year we must gather solemnly for the Republican Day of Remembrance, where we light candles and recite the list of Republicans who were brutally killed for living an authentic Republican life. It's why Republicans are routinely fired for from or denied jobs, banned from housing, and even, get this, prevented from receiving necessary medical care. And of course, let us never forget the fact that Republicans are not allowed to use bathrooms which align with their political identity. I ask you, dear listeners, have you ever seen a bathroom door which said it was Republican-friendly? I think not. I'm Una Nowling, and that's the transgender news for the week.
Earlier this year, we started a series called Transgender Kaleidoscope, where we highlight interesting individuals from the local Kansas City metropolitan community. We skipped that session last month due to having two special topic guests, so today we're going to have two kaleidoscoped guests. For our first guest, with us today in the studio is Grace Cox Johnson, a transgender woman who started her transition in 2008. She has a passion for music and acts as music director at Transfinity KC, Kansas City's own trans chorus, conducting them at Kansas City Pride this year, and is also music director at Blue Ridge Presbyterian Church. She is an expert in fabric dyeing and is happily married with two children. Hello, and welcome to Trans Talk.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Grace, could you introduce yourself to our audience to give a little bit of your background? Where did you grow up and spend your childhood?
I grew up in White Bluff, Tennessee. Well, Nashville to start with, and then we moved out to the country. My parents operated a Christian camp and conference center, mostly for fundamentalist churches. It was 150 acres out in the middle of the woods. It was a wonderful place to grow up. I grew up very religious, very conservative, Free Will Baptist, which is more conservative than Southern Baptist, if people want to have a reference point. It was a good church in terms of theology and some things. You know, it was Wesleyan, which meant you had some choices that you could make, unlike the Southern Baptist and a few other the fundamentalist, you know, folks. I went to Free Will Baptist Bible College my freshman year. And then I transferred to Wheaton College, the very famous school that has gotten into such trouble, going all the way to the Supreme Court to say that they didn't want to pay for decent health care for their female employees. Following that, I moved to Nashville and just kind of fell into this most wonderful opportunity. I got a grant to go to graduate school, got a master's degree in church music with an emphasis in choral conducting, and also was singing. I had a good solo position in a church choir that was paid. The whole choir was paid. So it was a really nice place to be at, you know, in that transition between undergraduate and graduate school. Got married to a United Methodist clergy person just a year or two after that. Was married and kind of a clergy spouse, you know, moving from parsonage to parsonage all over the state of Missouri until I came out as a gay. I mean, I guess my process of coming out was in two stages. I first came out as someone who was attracted to men, even though I was everybody thought I was a man. And then about 10 years later, I came out as transgender and actually started the process. Moved here in Kansas City in 2000 to go to St. Paul School of Theology. I did two semesters of that because it was just too much to run a business and also try to do that at the same time. But that's what got me here to Kansas City.
Thank you for that. Now, you said you came out in two stages, first as gay and then as transgender. But when did you first know you were transgender?
I got in trouble in kindergarten. Back in what would have been, you know, like 1963, for playing only in the dress-up and homemaking department of the kindergarten classroom. I guess it was a fairly progressive classroom. They had all these, you know, little stations where you could go and play and do stuff. So that was kind of progressive. But they didn't like the fact that all I did was dress up and want to cook and clean and pretend like that. So I was banned from that area for a little while. But I knew right then, I knew something was not right. I prayed, I think, for a solid year when I was in second or third grade for God to turn me into a girl. You know, I mean, because there was no other concept. There was no other way of understanding that. And since religion was my only base for, you know, transformation, I tried. But that didn't work either. I probably tried for many, many years to pray for to not be gay either or not be attracted to men, but that didn't work either. I don't know why I thought one would work and the other wouldn't.
I've heard that story so many times before from other transgender individuals, often in the context of they would go to bed praying, making the same prayer. I call it the transgender prayer. You know, please God, when I wake up, make me a girl or make me a boy. Normally with the attachment saying, or kill me.
Right. Very likely.
So when did you start to transition, and how easy or difficult was that for you?
It was not as difficult as I thought it might be. I had dated a trans a person who was in the middle of transition, who had really not started transition, but was kind of in the middle of that, and had done a lot of education because of that process. I had gone to a symposium that they had at the Country Club Congregational Church, where our group rehearses on Thursday nights, in case anybody wants to come, and read almost every book that I could get my hands on, which was quite a few. And then all of a sudden, my therapist, after a real tragedy in my life, I was in some grief therapy, and my therapist said, okay, what is it that we really need to work on? And we were in the plaza, and I walked outside his office and onto the plaza, and all I could see were those pretty dresses. All I could think about was wanting to wear those dresses. And I think the thing that I need to work on is gender. And from that moment on, I couldn't wear boy clothes. I mean, from that moment on, it's just like the realization was enough.
Did you experience any problems with friends or family accepting you?
Yeah, it was difficult at first with lots of people here close. You know, people who had known me so long, professional people all across the country. But for the most part, I had surrounded myself with pretty progressive folks. My parents, on the other hand, are still quite conservative, and I think more so now that the Republicans are stirring up all that fear Ilna was talking about earlier. But my parents still come visit. They still support somewhat financially, but I'm not allowed to visit their home anymore.
That's got to hurt.
Well, it's hard, but not just because of the emotional trauma of the rejection, but that space was so important to me. You know, the land in Tennessee was so vast and so beautiful. I just really miss that kind of earth experience that I don't get anywhere else.
Do you see any chance of reconciliation?
They're in their 80s, and I don't really see that happening. They're so grounded in their community and their belief structure or belief systems. It's not, I don't know. I don't even know that I would call it a theology, although I'm sure it could be defined that way. But it's more just a belief structure that's based on lies. I mean, the Bible makes certain statements, but you can twist anything in the scriptures to do anything you want it to do. I mean, it doesn't take much work at all.
No, and people always seem to find the bits that agree with what they think.
Exactly. We all do. Well, unfortunately, we all do on that one.
True. I know before you transitioned, you had a wife, and then you came out as gay, and you had two children. How did those revelations affect that?
The initial divorce from my former wife was probably the hardest thing I have ever had to deal with, ever. And hopefully I won't ever have to deal with anything quite that bad again, because it was the separation of our family. I moved only three houses down the street, though, or about four or five houses down the street. So we were in walking distance for the children to kind of do that. So the children were first and foremost in our lives, so they became the basis for those kinds of decisions. I'm not sure where the question was going, but
you said a pastor's spouse, so did you also have to lose your church and find a new community?
Well, I could have stayed at the church where she was the pastor, but I just felt completely exposed, so I moved churches and found actually a church where there was a lesbian pastor, which was wonderful, that she was fully out and fully accepted and loved, and so I knew that that would be a place where it wouldn't matter who I loved and who I wanted to be with. I knew that I would be accepted and loved there, and I still relate to that church. That church is in Columbia, Missouri, Rockbridge Christian Church. It's a wonderful place if you're looking and searching in that part of the world. But in Kansas City, I've been very fortunate to be surrounded by progressive Christian churches, which has been really, really, really wonderful.
Thinking about churches, I know that you know Donna Ross, who's a local transgender pastor, and she's now retired to Oregon. But you said she mentored you through your transition?
Yes. I had heard her speak at the UCC Church in Brookside, but also I had asked her to come to speak under the guise of the KCAVP to the church when I was at Broadway Church at 39th Terrace and Broadway. And I just really appreciated her because she was so articulate. It's one thing to be an activist. It's one thing to know what you're talking about, but it's a totally different thing to be able to do so in an articulate, understandable way. And I knew that she would be somebody that I could relate to, so I just kept calling until I got a response back and just latched on.
So how did she help you through your transition then as a mentor?
She guided every step. She worked with my doctor. She put my doctor in touch with the correct websites where they could do the research necessary. Told them the amount of the prescriptions. I mean, did everything. And then had an amazing transformation, which linked us together even more so because she actually became a pastor. This was before she even was relating to the church. So I got to be with her in the middle of that process of not being churched, finding the church, and it being an accepting place for her.
So you both had a transition of your own together.
Yes, we did.
And you managed to keep your original doctor. You didn't have any issues medically.
That's right, I did. He's gay, Dr. Killen, in Brookside Family Medical, and they're on Warnell Road, near Waldo, and it was absolutely wonderful. I didn't have to see another doctor. I had already been working with a therapist, and they were actually friends, so that made it easier too. I just had a call from my therapist to the doctor, and that's all it took.
That's great, being able to keep those relationships.
I know it's not as easy for some other people.
Yes, a lot of people lose their therapists or their doctors, and of course lots of people lose their partner when they transition, like
right.
you did,
right.
and they worry they'll never find anyone again. Tell us about how you found your husband, Mike, and how that relationship developed.
After a year of being in transition, I finally decided it is time. I want to date people. I want to meet a few people. And so we met on Craigslist. In fact, I met quite a few people there on Craigslist. It was kind of fun, but you know, just meeting for coffee, really simple. My ad on Craigslist could have been in any vacation Bible school or Sunday school program. It was as G-rated as it comes. And then we started dating. I think we dated 3 or 4 months before we finally moved in together, and been together for about 5 or 6 years now.
That sounds wonderful, especially given how afraid so many people are they'll never meet anyone.
That's right.
How was it? Were there any issues dating, like coming out as yourself to people, or any rejections?
No rejections during dating, but you know, not a lot of people. I mean, just a few people want to go out with you once. But I began to realize my life right now is like a normal woman. You know, the transition is kind of, it's not really that important to people. And I think that's true in a lot of large metropolitan areas. There's a lot of men who are very attracted to trans women who would not, you know, who you wouldn't think otherwise. Not just strangers, you know, not just fetishes, not just weirdos. There's lots of normal folks out there.
That's really good news. Now, I know, as well as Mike, I know music's really, really important in your life. Can you tell me about your musical activities, both at Blue Ridge Presbyterian Church and at Transfinity KC?
Sure.
And what does being a music director involve?
Well, for a church, it's a part-time position, but I direct the chancel choir and also am hoping to start a few other smaller ensembles in the next month or two. I'm actually the interim, you know, we really haven't officially hired someone, but I'm the interim artistic director for the Transfinity KC. I'm getting all those words right, I think.
Yes.
That's been one of the most exciting things I've ever done in my life, to actually start a new choir with the help of lots of people who are already plugged into the community, who know folks. We've been, I think, for a new group, extremely successful. It's hard to get a choir started, and it's been fun. Right now, I'm picking out music. We're not in rehearsals right now, so I'm picking out music for our fall concert, and that's been very exciting, too.
Can you tell me us a little bit about your fall concert?
It'll be in December, I believe December the 10th, although that's probably still coming together, and I'm not exactly sure where it's going to be either. We're hoping it's going to be at the UCC Church in Brookside, but we don't know for that for sure. We're going to be doing a little bit of Christmas, a little bit of this and that, the two pieces that we sang at Pride, also at the church in Brookside. But we're not going to focus on baby Jesus. And there won't be any religious or, you know, any kind of churchy stuff at the concert. There'll be some drumming. There'll be some other, you know, and hopefully another group as well. And a lot of variety of music. It's, you know, so all the way from the pop side all the way to, just basic classical contemporary literature, mm-hmm. which is uplifting for the soul, because that's our focus. It's going to be singing for peace.
That's a really good focus. I know there's also a fundraiser coming up for Transfinity KC October 1st.
Yes.
Yes.
So, yeah, you want to check on the Facebook page for all the information regarding our fundraiser coming up. But it's a gala. It's going to be a dinner and drinks and all of that good stuff to get to visit and network with people, too.
And if anyone wanted to get involved and join the chorus or any information, Facebook would be
absolutely
the best way.
Absolutely. Transfinity KC.
Great. And I know you, I mentioned you're an expert fabric dyer. You did the T-shirts and scarves and things for the chorus for the Pride performance. But you've actually turned that hobby into a way of actually making money, haven't
right.
you?
Right. For the last 25 years, I've been making stoles and vestments and banners and paraments. That was kind of one of the difficult things about transition, is that my job led me into some dicey circles in terms of who would be accepting and who wouldn't. Never knew. You know, so every private conversation or every personal conversation was a new revelation in terms of that. But I've been doing fabric first as a kind of a craft, you know, something fun as a hobby. But knowing church music and the symbols and the images and the colors of the church year, it kind of worked into a pretty good business. It was a much larger business when we were running with when we were distributed by Cokesbury Bookstores. But now it's kind of a small business.
Well, that sounds really great.
Oh, and the name of the business is Color for the Journey. I'm sorry, Color for the Journey.
That sounds really great and flexible. It sounds like you had a lot of good luck with the people you had as contacts, like Una did when she came out. Grace, I'd like to thank you very much for being with us today. It's been wonderful having you on. And now it's time for a music break.
Hello, and welcome back to Trans Talk. We just finished up a lovely interview with Grace Cox Johnson, and now we're going to move on to our next guest. During the break, we were listening to the song Am I the Same Girl by Swing Out Sister, a song from my era, the 1980s and so forth, which unfortunately puts me kind of in the older side of the community, I'm afraid. This week, I was invited to organize a group to speak at Webster University on the subject of the transgender experience, sort of a Trans 101 class to a group of graduate counseling students. I chose two people to come with me to share their experiences, and one of them is in the studio with us today. Gus is a transgender man who has also been a mentor and educator during his continued journey, and he is very close to his goal of just being a guy who is, you know, just living, loving, working in America and so forth. He today was working very hard on fixing his air conditioner at his house because it was in the 90s overnight for him. Gus has been at the transition process longer than many people that I know, including myself, and he's picked up a fair bit of wisdom along the road to share with us. Hello, Gus. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Una.
I normally ask folks to tell me, you know, where the conflict began with their gender identity and a bit about their experience, but I'd like instead for you to talk a little bit about where you are right now. What is it like to be Gus right now with your job and your family and life after having come so far?
Well, I mean, it's a lot of times it's the transition part of it is really, really not as big of an issue. I mean, it comes up, but it's not sort of the primary thing. The primary thing is, you know, getting to work on time and dealing with the heat and being new in sort of a shift in careers. I'm working on trucks now. I'm not you know, doing the same thing that I was doing before. So that's been a little intimidating, but you know, I stay busy, and the transition is sort of Sort of a secondary layer. It's not the not really the primary focus. It has been a focus.
Of course.
Been a big focus. A lot of my life, but it had sort of shifted away from that being the primary focus, and it's kind of shifted back, so it is more of a focus now than it had been. I'm working towards the goal of lower surgery, which, you know, a lot of people don't like to discuss, and we don't have to go into details,
right.
But it's something that's important to me, and so I want to, you know, maintain a positive conversation about that, you know, when that's appropriate.
You told me once that you were pressured into gender conformity when you were younger and by a few different directions. I think your mother was one of the influences there. And you also mentioned this week that when you were in college, you found that just by the simple act of cutting your hair short, I believe you described it as the lesbians descended upon you.
Yes.
At college. Do you think we're moving towards a society which will be better at just recognizing and accepting gender nonconformity without making an assumption about sexual preference?
You know, I think so. I know a lot more folks that I think sort of straddle this sort of ambiguous place, and they really sort of celebrate that, and that's great. I've always been fairly masculine, you know, I think that's a thing that I feel like it needs to be celebrated about me, and you know, not something that needs to be pressured on anyone else. But I've always really just liked the things that I liked, and I appreciated the fact that my dad really sort of defended my right to be who I was, and he didn't want my spirit crushed. So I think that as long as we're not sort of putting expectations on people, then we can sort of move to a place where, you know, all different kinds of expressions can be, you know, celebrated and honored.
And what would you say was your greatest challenge to your transition, and how did you overcome it?
Greatest challenge? I feel like that's sort of a layered question. There were challenges in terms of employment and just sort of sheer survival. You know, and having my appearance be masculine and being read as male after I started testosterone, and then all of my documentation still having my old name and still saying female. And so how do I avoid that? Do I feel safe at this particular place of employment disclosing, you know, or do I need to sort of come up with some excuse as to why I only use my initials, and oh, I don't have my Social Security card on me today, and dodging all of that sort of you know, incongruence between my documentation and my presentation was a big nightmare. But also, you know, the fear of losing family and losing community, and I did. I lost a lot of community. And that was really hard, sort of, because I had sort of come into this place where I, you know, all of these people that had a coming out experience in the gay and lesbian community, they had all had this, and then I had it twice. And the people that understood that I had it the first time then were rejecting me and cutting me out of what I felt like my quote-unquote community had been. It wasn't the best fit, but it was the closest thing I'd ever known. And so losing all of that was – I had to grieve that, and I didn't understand it. It felt like hypocrisy. And then my family, who had been so biased when I had told them that I was dating women, then really kind of stepped up to the plate, and it was hard work, but they got through it. And I was, you know, I was extraordinarily impressed by my father, who had grown up in a really small rural town in southeast Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. And he was so biased in so many ways that for him to really address this sort of a radical existence, you know, for him, that it was, you know, that was a big challenge. But he just kept swinging.
Now, this would be a very difficult question, and would require you to be a mind reader, I think. But why was your father so accepting?
I think it was because he had been. I think he had assumed he wasn't ever going to have children. He was 45 when I was born. He had been married once before, and his first wife was diabetic, to the such a severity that she was not able to even consider having children. I don't even know if it was a possibility. But then he was single for a long time. So he was 45 when I was born, and he was 48 when my younger brother was born. And I don't think he had thought that that was going to be a possibility. And so I think that for him, just seeing me as I was, he just loved me. And I think he was so grateful to be a father that I think he just accepted that whatever that came, you know, whatever came along with that, he was able to handle. And, you know, he just loved very unconditionally.
Maybe when he saw you as a lesbian, he was afraid he was never going to get grandchildren.
I think that that was probably the hardest thing for him to accept, was that seeing me as a lesbian was difficult. I think he was concerned about what the future looked like for me. I think he was also concerned about that whenever I told him that I planned to transition. And I think that, you know, I think it was really hard for him to understand. I don't think he recognized that testosterone was going to just sort of allow this sort of magical transformation. That it was just, I think he thought I was always going to look like, you know, his daughter, but like with a mustache. And so I don't think he realized that it was going to be this sort of this full on puberty, and that, you know,
right.
Within 2 years I looked just like him and just like my uncle and just like my brother, and like I had always sort of thought I was supposed to look. And I had always been read as very masculine anyway. I mean, people would say, ask me if I was a boy or a girl, or they would say, excuse me, sir, oh, I'm sorry, whenever they would hear my voice, and my voice was a lot more feminine than my appearance had been. So, you know, I think that he was very concerned with what my life would look like at living as a lesbian. But I think that once he realized that, you know, there was still something eating at me, and that you know, me trying to force myself to live this life as a female that I'd never really wanted, you know, I think he sort of, it clicked that I was so unhappy as a child, and that, you know, when I was allowed to do what I wanted to do, I was a little boy, I was climbing trees, I was throwing rocks, I was, you know, getting dirt in my face, and you know, I was very rowdy and roughhousing all of the time. And you know, that then when, as my teachers and as my mom and, you know, even my older sister sort of pressured me out of a lot of that, you know, it did crush my spirit. I wasn't allowed to be me. I had to be so self-conscious all of the time, and I had to constantly be, you know, policing what I liked, and, oh, if I like this too much, am I going to get in trouble? And so seeing, you know, him seeing me sort of come full circle, and I was just allowed to be sort of always who I always had been, I think that that just allowed him to, okay, this can be okay. I mean, I'm not able to have children, so he didn't have any grandchildren.
Yes.
So you know, it came at a cost, but I was so surprised. So I can't be more blessed than I to have had him as a dad, you know.
That's wonderful.
I was going to add one thing to that, because you had mentioned that after the transition really kicked in, you looked very much like the other male members of your family, which was, we'd actually talked about that this week, sort of the privilege of being able to pass and hide or blend in among the cisgender community. And I have to inform my audience, since you can't see in the studio, that Gus is, you know, real damn handsome and manly dude here. But Gus, you also mentioned, though, that there's still a masculine pecking order that you have to deal with that is body focused in some ways, like when you're competing for jobs. Can you talk a little bit about that experience?
Yes, I've always worked in sort of highly skilled labor positions.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very technically minded. I'm very mechanical. You know, I'm able to take things apart and put them back together, figure out, you know.
Like your air conditioner.
Right. Well, unlike my air conditioner, I had to have help from my brother. But I'm the machinery and engines and things like that, I'm able to diagnose. So I am, you know, like 5'5", with boots on. So I'm short. I look very, very young compared to what my actual, you know, numerical value of age. So I typically am not read for my age, And so I, being young-faced and being smaller framed, I'm often going up against, you know, men who are like 6 foot two and 250, and you know, so it's I'm asked about privilege a lot, and yes, I am, you know, cis passing. I kind of hate the term passing, but just for the sake of this conversation, and I'm white, and I'm, you know, I'm married to a woman, so I'm, you know, straight white guy. And yes, there's privilege that is assumed with that, but I'm also, you know, in a field where men don't like to answer to someone who looks younger than them or to mm-hmm. someone who is shorter than them. And so it's been a struggle still. It's, you know, transition just hasn't handed me the keys to the kingdom. And so, you know, yes, I probably have more privilege than what I had being read as a masculine female, especially as baby-faced as I was, especially then. But I think that... I think a lot of that privilege goes hand in hand with how much space you take up. And being socialized female, we discussed this at Webster the other night. I still am often talked over, and so I allow that to happen. So I think that, you know, yes, there are people who are inclined to take up a lot of space, and there are people who are not. And I think that I am at least considered of the space that I take up.
I struggled a bit about that with my transition because I found that suddenly when I went into corporate boardrooms or much worse, at a power plant or something in a meeting there or working in the control room, that all of a sudden people weren't listening to me. I carried with me a male privilege when I was going in that I was the smartest person in the room and they were going to listen to me. And very, very quickly, within a couple months, I became some lady who's in here poking her nose into other people's business. Mm-hmm. And I
think that there's sort of this good old boy, sort of a camaraderie and a system. And I think that they sense when someone either feels that they don't belong mm-hmm. there or they look like they don't belong there. I don't have, you know, pictures on my Facebook of me in my high school football uniform or, you know, things like that. And so, you know, and I don't have that that history of, oh, I went to high school with so-and-so, or I was in a fraternity at, you know,
right.
University of blah-blah-blah with, you know, John over here, you know. So I don't have that. And I feel like they even, because I don't disclose at most of my jobs. I have had to a couple of times getting security background checks and stuff like that. So I have had to disclose, but I typically don't choose to. I don't want that to be a focus, and I don't want that to impact my ability to provide. And so I don't discuss it if I don't have to.
Certainly.
So I don't feel like it's hiding, but because I don't mind talking about it. I don't feel like, you know, I don't hide from, you know, being involved in my community. I just don't tell it when I don't have to. But I feel like even though they don't know, I feel like they still pick up on there's something about me that's not like them. So like there's sort of a blood in the water sort of thing.
I don't know. Sorry, I don't know if that's because of sensing something about you, but there are studies that say for even cis males, if you've got two guys of the same qualifications, the job will go to the taller one, like 9 times out of 10. So that is, even with passing privilege, that is always going to be an issue for most of the trans men out mm-hmm. there.
I think the privilege is a layered thing. It's sort of an intersectional thing. It, you know, it's not just your race. It's not just your, you know, your religion. It's not just whether or not you're, you know, hetero passing or, you know, cis passing. There's sort of a lot of layers, and I think that size and, you know, are you
size
over,
matters.
How tall are you? Are you overweight? Are you attractive? Do you have a decent beard? You know, like there's sort of so many things that goes into how you're read and how you're judged at that sort of, you know, that sort of initial point of contact.
And beards coming into fashion and being socially acceptable again has to be a good thing for trans men, because most of them really want to have a beard to show that symbol of masculinity.
Well, I had partners prior to this one that were very sort of mixed about facial hair. Like, oh, the sideburns are okay, and oh, like the goatee is okay, but I don't like anything on the lip, and oh, you just look dirty when you're trying to grow it out. So, and there's so much negativity and there's so much judgment. Like, there's so many women who are and maybe men too, but there's so many women who are very outspoken about, like, oh, I don't like that. That looks dirty. Shave it off. And I really hate that. That's something that really bothers me, and it kept me from feeling comfortable in, you know, sort of playing around with facial hair. And then I am fortunate that I have support around me now. But a few years ago, I decided I was going to grow out my beard for No Shave November, and there were people around me who were really supportive, and luckily I was, I don't have a partner who is unsupportive of that now, because I have had so many. And so I like my appearance now more than ever. I also had a Bell's palsy, a paralysis of the right hand side of my face that I never really recovered from, and so my face is not as symmetrical as it used to be. And so I felt like I had sort of entered into this ugly phase in my life. And so then I grew out a beard, and it takes a lot of patience, because everybody has thinner patches in their facial hair. And so it was a patience thing. I made myself wait for 4 to 6 weeks before trimming or touching or anything, because I read on a beard board that you're supposed to. I obsessed over facial hair for a while there.
Wait, there are beard message boards?
There are. And
Fanciers Weekly.
Surprisingly, they're mostly cis men, and a lot of them have partners who are very unsupportive, and families who are very unsupportive. Ooh, shave that off. Oh, I like you better without it. And so that is actually one of the most supportive communities I've ever been involved in, is the beard community. And
wow.
So it's kind of ridiculous, I know, but I don't talk about it a lot because people laugh, but there are a lot of cis men who are very insecure about their beards, and I do feel fortunate that mine has come in as much as it has. It's still coming in. Just a few years ago that my mustache and my beard didn't connect. But I feel better with a beard than I've ever felt without it. And I doubt I'll ever shave clean again, ever in my life.
I hope you never have to.
I hope so too.
Now, I know you've really struggled with the very high cost of surgical transition, and for transgender men that can easily run into six figures. Can you talk about what you've had to go through to pay for what you've already been able to accomplish, and what you're having to do to try and finish your own personal transformation journey?
Yes, I've paid for everything out of pocket, and not a single drop of testosterone, not a single stitch of surgery that has happened prior. I've had a chest reconstruction and hysterectomy. I have not had phalloplasty, is what I intend to have, and that is the more expensive surgical route that trans men sometimes choose to go through. Some of them choose not to, which is great. I really envy those that
don't
feel like that's a necessity, but I've got to the place where it is a necessity for sort of a lot of reasons. All of them are about me, not about anyone mm-hmm. else. And I feel like, it is hugely cost prohibitive, and I feel like that's a lot of the reason why the conversation sort of steers away from, I don't want it. I think it's easier to accept that you don't want it than it is to accept that it is out of the realm of possibility. I took a job at a pay cut with inclusive insurance, because without insurance, it's not feasible. So that's been kind of hard for me. I don't love the job that I'm at. I can make the best anywhere, but it's not the ideal fit for me. It's definitely something that I'm doing until, I get this all taken care of, and then can maybe bid on a job that I like better, because I really do like the corporation and their structure and their policies, but corporate policies don't always translate to the individual locations. Not everybody subscribes to these really, flowery and protective, and progressive ideologies, yes, and practices and stuff. So it all sounds great on paper, and you can sign their code of conduct, but that doesn't mean that, you know, my immediate supervisor is going to be supportive when I have to be out recovering from, you know, as serious of a surgery as this,
yes,
is.
You told me that you don't consider yourself to be an activist, but you do have significant experience working in the community as a mentor and an educator, and outside of the community as well. And I think you said you've spoken at least 15 different colleges, for example. I struggle sometimes trying to get other trans folks to come and help me speak and reach out to the community. I know there's this new mode of thinking that, well, people in a community, it's not their job to educate people outside of it. So they would actually propose that cisgender people would get together and talk about how they are, you know, how they have transphobia and so forth. But what do you personally get out of speaking about your journey and speaking about the community?
You know, I've gotten probably the most out of working with kids, mm-hmm, transmasculine children and their families. I think sort of seeing, not that these kids are little me, but looking at another family who is dealing with a situation that looked similar to mine, and seeing, you know, that my childhood, while it was sort of unusual, it wasn't the only one of its kind. That has really helped, you know, sort of bring things full circle again for me. And seeing, you know, seeing a kid leave with their load a little lighter, you know, after meeting someone else, and seeing, okay, you know, I'm not necessarily going to turn out exactly like Gus, but Gus turned out okay, so I think I'll be okay. You know, I was reluctant to be as involved in the community as I am. It's not something that I ever really pictured myself doing. That's one of the reasons why I don't really feel comfortable with the label of activist. I've been reluctant, to say the least, but I've never said no. And I guess wherever I see that there's a need, you know, I feel like, okay, well, then it falls on me. And I don't feel like I have any obligation to educate at every turn.
Right.
But
right,
certainly where there is, you know, a willing audience or a willing ear, then I feel like the conversation is important. I don't feel like my story is the most important. I don't feel like my transition has been extraordinarily, you know, tragic or it's not necessarily the hardest story to tell. You know, there are things about it that have been ugly and painful, but there's also been a lot of it that have been, you know, easier than other stories. You know, I'm definitely lucky to, you know, have not had to deal with being a racial minority on top of being a trans man.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I definitely feel like there's, you know, there's a lot of layers to it.
Well, I'd like to thank you very much, Gus, for coming into our studio today and sharing your story with us, just as we discussed.
Anytime. I appreciate you having me.
Thank you.
Hello, I'm Fiona Nelling, and this is the Kansas City Community Calendar for the month. There's a couple of events from the Transgender Institute before we leave July. On the 28th, they are having an evening of beauty and transformation for feminine transgender persons in the Midwest from 6 to 8:30 p.m. at Bravada's Wig Design Boutique at 11004 Metcalf Avenue, Overland Park, Kansas. Refreshments will be provided. For more information, visit the transinstitute.org website.
That usually means wine.
Yes, it does usually mean wine. So I guess even if you're not transfeminine, you could arrive for the wine. On the 31st of July, our own Una Nowling will be presenting on religion and being transgender from 3 to 5 p.m. For more details, visit transinstitute.org website or transthecity.org for the location. Kansas City Black Pride is August 5th to the 7th, and it is the 16th year it has run. For more details on the schedule, you can visit www.facebook.com/KansasCityBlackPride. Passage's LGBTQ Youth Center meets at Trinity United Methodist Church every Wednesday from 5:30 to 9 p.m. for ages 14 to 20. That's at 620 East Armour Boulevard, Kansas City, Missouri. A transgender support group organized by Dr. Hiten Soni will run the first and third Saturday of the month from 1 to 2:30 p.m. The group is open to all transgender persons, allies, and family members, and is free to attend. The address is 901 Kentucky Avenue, Suite 303, Lawrence, Kansas. Hear Me Out Toastmasters will be meeting at 6 p.m. at the Light Me Lighthouse on the second and fourth Wednesday of the month. Hear Me Out Toastmasters is an LGBT enthused group which meets to practice public speaking and leadership skills. And every Thursday, the Equal Trans Support Group meets at Light Me Lighthouse at 5 p.m., so the August meeting will be on the 18th. Equal Trans Support Group will be working as grounds crew at the Kansas City Renaissance Festival on October the 1st and 10th. This is a fundraising opportunity for their organization, so if you wish to help, contact them on etsg2011@gmail.com for more information. Every month, I lead the Kansas City SOFA group for significant others, friends, family, and allies of transgender persons. We will meet on the first and third Wednesday of this month at Leawood Pioneer Library, on August the 3rd at 6:30 in Study Room 115, and on the 17th at 6:30 in Study Room 116. For driving directions and other SOFA information, you can visit transcitycity.org/SOFA. And that's it for the community calendar for the upcoming month. And now I'd like to thank you for tuning in to Trans Talk, this week's edition of The Tenth Voice. Many thanks to our special guests, Grace and Gus, our sound engineer and producer, Linda Wilson, and last but not least, my co-host and wife, Una Nowling. You can always send an email with your thoughts and suggestions to thetenthvoice@gmail.com.